I could scarcely drag myself from my couch at dawn, for I seemed barely to have closed my eyes to sleep before it was time to open them again. My reflection in the bronze mirror was haggard, and my eyes were underscored in purple. Swiftly I touched on makeup to cover the worst of my sorry condition, enhancing the hollows of my eyes with kohl and my pale features with a brushing of antimony. Two of the slave boys combed out my hair, and I was so pleased with the result that I felt almost cheerful as I hurried down to the Grand Vizier's private dock, where the great state barge lay moored. I was amongst the last to join the throng upon the quay, but no one seemed to notice my late arrival, not even my Lady Lostries, who was already on the deck of the barge. I watched her for a while. She had been invited to join the royal women. These comprised not only the king's wives, but his numerous concubines and all his daughters. Of course, these last were the cause of much of Pharaoh's unhappiness, a flock of them ranging in age from crawlers and toddlers to others of marriageable age, and not a son amongst them. How was Pharaoh's immortality to be maintained without a male line to carry it forward? It was difficult to believe that, like me, Lostris had not slept more than an hour or two, for she seemed as sweet and fresh as one of the desert roses in my garden. Even in that glittering array of feminine beauty that had been hand-picked by Pharaoh's factors, or sent to him in tribute by his satraps at the ends of the empire, Lostris stood out like a swallow in a flock of drab little desert larks. I looked for Tunnus, but his squadron was already lying well upstream, ready to escort Pharaoh's crossing, and the reflection of the rising sun turned the surface of the river into a dazzling silver sheet that blinded the eye. I could not look into it. At that moment there was the steady boom of a drum, and the populace craned to watch Pharaoh's stately progress down from the palace to the royal barge. This morning he wore the light Nemus crown of starched and folded linen, secured around his forehead with the gold bands of the uraeus. The erect golden cobra, with its hood flared and its garnet eyes glittering, rose up from his brow. The cobra was the symbol of the powers of life and death that Pharaoh held over his subjects. The king was not carrying the crook and flail, only the golden scepter. After the double crown itself, this was the most holy treasure of all the crown jewels, and was reputed to be over 1,000 years old. Despite all the regalia and the ceremonial, Pharaoh wore no makeup. Under the direct rays of the early sun, and without makeup to disguise the fact, Mimosa himself was unremarkable. Just a soft little godling of late middle age, with a small round paunch bulging over the waistband of his kilt, and features intricately carved with lines of worry. As he passed where I stood, it seemed he recognized me, for he nodded slightly. I immediately prostrated myself on the paving, and he paused and made a sign for me to approach. I crawled forward on hands and knees, and knocked my forehead 3 times on the ground at his feet. "Are you not Taita the poet?" he asked, in that thin and petulant voice of his. "I am Taita the slave, your majesty," I replied. There are times when a little humility is called for. "But I am also a poor scribbler." "Well, Taita the slave, you scribbled to good effect last night. I've never been so well entertained by a pageant. I shall issue a royal edict declaring your poor scribblings to be the official version." He announced this loud enough for all the court to hear, and even my Lord Intef, who followed him closely, beamed with pleasure. As I was his slave, the honour belonged to him more than to me. However, Pharaoh was not finished with me yet. "Tell me, Taita the slave, are you not also the same surgeon who recently prescribed to me?" "Majesty, I am that same humble slave who has the temerity to practice a little medicine." "Then when shall your cure take effect?" He dropped his voice so that only I could hear the question. "Majesty, the event will take place 9 months after you have fulfilled all those conditions that I listed for you." As we were now in a surgeon and patient relationship, I felt emboldened to add, "Have you followed the diet I set you?" "By Isis' bountiful breasts," he exclaimed with an unexpected twinkle in his eye, "I am so full of bull's balls it is a wonder that I do not bellow when a herd of cows passes the palace." He was in such a pleasant mood that I tried a little joke of my own. "Has Pharaoh found the heifer?" I suggested. "Alas, doctor, it is not as simple as it would seem. The prettiest flowers are soonest visited by the bee. You did stipulate that she must be completely untouched, did you not?" virgin and untouched, and within a season of her first red moon, I added quickly, making it as difficult as possible to put my recipe to the test. Have you found one who meets that description, Majesty? His expression changed again, and he smiled thoughtfully. The smile looked out of place on those melancholy features. We shall see, he murmured, we shall see. And he turned and mounted the boarding ladder of the barge. As my Lord Intef drew level with me, he made a small gesture, ordering me to fall in behind him, and so I followed him up onto the deck of the royal barge. The wind had dropped during the night, and the dark waters of the river seemed heavy and quiet as oil in the jar, disturbed only by those streaks and whirlpools upon the surface where the eternal current ran deep and swift. Even Nembet should be able to make the crossing in these conditions, although Tanus' squadron stood by in most unflattering fashion, as if Tanus was preparing to rescue him from error once again. My Lord Intef drew me aside as soon as we reached the deck. "You still have the power to surprise me sometimes, my old darling," he whispered, and squeezed my arm. "Just when I was seriously beginning to doubt your loyalty." I was taken aback by this sudden flush of goodwill, since the welts from Rasfer's lash across my back still ached. However, I bowed my head to shield my expression and waited for him to give me direction before committing myself, which he did immediately. I could not have written a more appropriate declamation for Tanis to recite before Pharaoh if I had tried myself. Where that imbecile Rasfer failed so dismally, you retrieved the day for me in your usual style. It was only then that it all fell into place. He believed that I was the author of Tanis' monumental folly, and that I had composed it for his benefit. In the uproar of the temple, he could not have heard my shouted warnings to Tanis, or he would have known better. I am pleased that you are pleased, I whispered back to him. I felt an enormous sense of relief. My position of influence had not been compromised. It was not my own skin I was thinking of at that moment, well, not entirely. I was thinking of Tanus and Lostris. They would need every bit of help and protection that I could give them during the stormy days that lay ahead for both of them. I was grateful that I was still in a position to be of some use to them. It was no less than my duty. Thus I made the most of this windfall. You will find me grateful, my Lord Intef replied. Do you remember the piece of ground on the canal behind the Temple of Thoth that we discussed some time ago? Indeed, my lord. We both knew that I had hankered after that plot for 10 years. It would make a perfect writer's retreat, and a place to which I could retire in my old age. It is yours. At my next assize, bring the deed to me for my signature. I was stunned and appalled by the vile manner in which it had come into my possession, as payment for an imagined piece of treachery on my part. For a moment I thought of rejecting the gift, but only for a moment. By the time I had recovered from my shock, we were across the river and pulling into the mouth of the canal that led across the plain to Pharaoh Mamosa's great funerary temple. I had surveyed this canal with only minimal help from the royal architects, as I had planned virtually single-handed the whole complicated business of the transport of Pharaoh's body from the place of his death to the funerary temple where the mummification process would take place. I had assumed that he would die at his palace on lovely little Elephantine Island. Therefore, his corpse would be brought downriver in the state barge. I had designed the canal to accommodate the huge ship snugly. So now she slipped into it as neatly as the sword into its scabbard. Straight as the blade of my dagger, the canal cut through the black loam soil of the riparian plain 2,000 paces to the foot of the gaunt Saharan foothills. Tens of thousands of slaves had laboured over the years to build it, and to line it with stone blocks. As the barge nosed into the canal, 200 sturdy slaves seized the tow ropes from the bows and began to draw her smoothly across the plain. They sang one of the sad, melodious work chants as they marched in ranks along the towpath. The peasants working in the fields beside the canal ran to welcome us. They crowded to the bank, calling blessing on the king and waving palm fronds, as the great barge moved majestically by. When at last we slid into the stone dock below the outer walls of the half-finished temple, the slaves made the tow ropes fast to the moorings. So precise was my design that the entry port in the bulwark of the state barge lined up exactly with the portals of the main gate to the temple. As the huge vessel came to rest, the trumpeter in the bows blew a fanfare on his gazelle horn, and the portcullis was raised slowly to reveal the royal hearse waiting in the gateway, attended by the company of embalmers in their crimson robes, and 50 priests of Osiris in rank behind them. The priests began to chant as they trundled the hearse forward on its wooden rollers, onto the deck of the barge. Pharaoh clapped his hands with delight and hurried forward to examine this grotesque vehicle. I had taken no part in the conception of this celebration of bad taste. It was entirely the work of the priests. Suffice it only to say that in the naked sunlight the superabundant goldwork shone so brightly as to offend the eye almost as painfully as did the actual design. Such weight of gold forced the priests to pant and sweat as they manhandled the clumsy ark onto the deck, and it listed even the great ship, alarmingly. That weight of gold could have filled all the grain stores of the Upper Kingdom, or built and fitted out 50 squadrons of fighting ships, and paid their crews for 10 years. Thus the inept craftsman's attempt to hide the paucity of his inspiration behind a dazzle of treasure. If only they had given me such material to work with, they might have seen something different. This monstrosity was destined to be sealed in the tomb with Pharaoh's dead body. No matter that its construction had contributed largely to the financial ruin of the kingdom, Pharaoh was delighted with it. At my Lord Intef's suggestion, the king mounted the vehicle and took his seat on the platform designed to carry his sarcophagus. From there he beamed about him, all his dignity and royal reserve forgotten. He was probably enjoying himself as much as he ever had in all his gloomy life. I reflected this with a pang of pity. His death was to be the pinnacle to which most of his living energy and anticipation were directed. On what was clearly an impulse, he beckoned my Lord Intef to join him on the ark, and then looked around the crowded deck as if seeking someone else in the throng. He seemed to find who he wanted, for he stooped slightly and said something to the Grand Vizier. My Lord Intef smiled, and following his direction singled out my Lady Lostris. With a gesture he ordered her to come to him on the ark. She was clearly flustered, and blushed under her make-up, a rare phenomenon for one who was so seldom caught out of countenance. However, she recovered swiftly and mounted the carriage with girlish, long-legged grace that, as usual, carried every eye with her. She knelt before the king and touched her forehead 3 times to the floor of the platform. Then, in front of all the priests and the entire court, Pharaoh did an extraordinary thing. He reached down and took Lostri's hand and lifted her to her feet and seated her beside him on the platform. It was beyond all protocol. There was no precedent for it, and I saw his ministers exchange looks of amazement. Then something else happened, of which even they were not aware. When I was very young, there had lived in the boys' quarters an old deaf slave who had befriended me. It was he who had taught me to read men's speech not only by the sound of it, but also by the shape of their lips, as they formed the words. It was a very useful accomplishment. With it I could follow a conversation at the far end of a crowded hall, with musicians playing and 100 men around me laughing and shouting at each other. Now, before my eyes, I saw Pharaoh say softly to my Lady Lostris, "Even in daylight you are as divine as was the goddess Isis in the torchlight of the temple." The shock of it was like the blow of a fist to my stomach. Had I been blind, I berated myself desperately, or had I merely been stupid? Surely any imbecile must have anticipated the direction in which my capricious meddling must incline the order in which the dice of destiny might fall. My facetious advice to the king must inevitably have had the effect of directing his attention towards my Lady Lostris. It was as though some malignant impulse below the surface of my mind had set out to describe her precisely to him as the mother of his firstborn son.